Mike, first of all, I guess I need to ask the question, what do I call you? Do I call you Mike, Michael, Dr. Whitmore, Sarah, Milord? How does one refer to?
I prefer citizen.
Citizen.
No, you can call me Mike.
Mike, okay. But you are, give me the exact zippy title.
I am the director of the Folger Shakespeare Library.
And you're the only, the seventh one in its in the...
There is some debate among historians whether I'm the seventh or the sixth. All I know is that I sit behind Henry Clay Folger's desk. I've been on the job for about 2 weeks and it's enormously exciting.
Yeah.
I get to sit here and talk to people like you. I'm in the building that contains the largest collection of early English books in North America, third largest collection of those books in the world.
Wow.
And the largest collection of Shakespeare's source texts, the folios and quartos that we have of his plays, in the world. So it's really like sitting on top of a mountain.
So there, bitches.
I say that often.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, whatever it is, wherever you are. Thanks for subscribing, streaming, or downloading and listening to us on your computer or MP3 player. I'm Austin Titchener, one-third of the Reduced Shakespeare Company, and you're listening to this week's Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast, number 247, Folger Library Director. In the summer of 2010, we were given a personal private tour of the vaults of the Folger Shakespeare Library in Washington, D.C., one of the premier research libraries and repositories of old texts in the world. You can find the podcast of that tour in our archives as episode 191. This summer, in 2011, I was invited back to meet the new director of the Folger Shakespeare Library, Michael Whitmore. As you'll hear, Michael is a fascinating guy and a lover of Shakespeare and ancient texts, and he began by telling me that even though he'd only been on the job less than a month, he and the Folger have a long professional association.
Actually, to tell you the truth, my first paying job when I got out of college was as a telemarketer for the Folger Shakespeare Theater.
Really?
So I used to call people up during dinner time and say, "Hi, how you doing? I'm calling from the Folger Shakespeare Library. Please give us some money."
Mm-hmm.
And that was that was a great experience. Taught me a lot.
Is that the job you're doing now? or do you have people to do that?
I don't use the telephone.
Right. But is fundraising part of what you do, or do you have a development office?
I have a development office. Fundraising is part of what I do. Mm-hmm. To make a place like this go, you need to shovel in coal. It's a constant process. But it's something I enjoy doing because I get to talk about how great Shakespeare is, and I get to talk to people who are really interested and really passionate about it. So it's great.
Well, let's start then with how great Shakespeare is. Seriously, what is it about Shakespeare? And has it always been Shakespeare, or did it used to be some other aspect of literature or theater?
It's always been Shakespeare for me.
Yeah.
I started out, it's kind of a funny story, but I started out life as an evangelical Pentecostal, and so we used to read the King James Bible every day.
Wow.
And there came a point in my life where I was in high school, I read a Shakespeare play, I heard the language, and I said, "Wait a minute, I've heard this before." And that opened up a whole set of doors for me. I kind of knew the language, had been used to thinking about it, but it was another world. And that was the beginning of kind of a lifelong romance with Shakespeare. But, you know, there's a lot of debate about whether Shakespeare is not as good or better than other people in the Renaissance, like Ben Jonson, and now we have Middleton.
Mm-hmm.
I'm one of those people who thinks Shakespeare is the guy.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that? Well, I think that he tells stories, in my own opinion, about what it's like to be this kind of person in this kind of world. And he'll try out different people. What happens if you're an outsider? What happens if you're too young or too old or from the wrong family? And he's really good at showing what it's like to be in that place or that position. So I think he's got something to him. And the other thing that I love about him is that the guy worked on the South Bank of London. He was an entertainer. He was a stockholder in his own theater company. So it wasn't like he was sitting in some kind of quiet room where no one ever arrived there, you know, and he would once in a while put his pen to paper, but give no thought to anyone else in their worlds. I think he was right in the middle of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And that makes me, you know, it makes me love him.
Because he's one of us, almost.
Well, he's a 400-year-old version of us.
Yeah.
And his world is probably just as complicated as ours is. I mean, yeah. The Reformation had happened in England. People were killing each other over things like whether, what kind of clothes you wear in church if you're a priest. And he knew what it was like to write in a world that felt conflict. Really passionate.
Well, and there's you say talk about what it's like to be this person in this world. He does it with a specificity. You, from the specifics come the universal. You
sure.
know, why is he... Yeah. So why is he more popular now or as better remembered than Ben Jonson, than Thomas Middleton, than any of the others, do you think?
Well,
what sets him apart, I guess?
Well, I think Shakespeare was an incredible student of life. He didn't go to, for what we know, he didn't travel to Italy or to Bohemia. He got some things wrong about Bohemia.
What?
Well, there's no coastline, so I have a hard time dropping off a lost baby. But that's okay. It's the stage, and, you know, I think people probably didn't give him too hard a time about that.
I believe it's called creative license.
The suspension of disbelief.
Yeah.
But I think that he read very carefully, and he read a lot, and he remembered what he read. So he hadn't been to Bohemia or Italy, but he'd probably read a lot of things about what it was like to be there, and he'd talked to people who had been there.
Yeah.
And because he's moving around London, the city that's exploding with population, full of life, it's the beginning of what we think of as modern metropolitan commercial life. It's the beginning of the exploration of the Atlantic. There is a huge amount that's happening in London. You've got what we would call middle class people today coming up through business instead of inheriting land. So there's all this conflict about, well, who are you? You're not really dressed like a noble, but you speak in that way, or you're dressed like a noble, but you don't have any family pedigree. I think the world he was in was very confused, and he paid a lot of attention.
Well, and he was a smart guy. Basically, he knew he had to get his plays on past the censors. You know,
sure.
he needed to say what he wanted to say without getting, you know, burned as a heretic himself or whatever.
And, you know, he's very good at not getting burned.
Yeah.
We know of a lot of early modern playwrights who get pulled in or prosecuted.
Yeah.
Ben Jonson's a great example. Why was it that Shakespeare got away with what he did? I think you're right. He was careful. He was clever.
Yeah.
It may also have been that he was all... One of the things I notice about him as a writer is that he'll start with one topic, but he moves on pretty quickly. And that's why he's so hard to keep up with.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one minute he's talking about love. The next second he's talking about boarding a ship in a sea battle. And then 5 minutes later, you know, one topic after another. Right. The mind keeps going. I think that being that nimble also kept him from landing too long on any one topic that could have gotten him in trouble.
Well, and he uses all the tricks in his bag. If you get bored of poetry, there'll be a little prose coming on. If you get bored of romance, there'll be a sword fight coming along.
That's right.
You know, he wanted to keep as you said, he was an entertainer.
I think that's right.
He wanted,
I mean, maybe you get this from performing his plays, but what is it about his plays that make him easier to kind of get around as a performer, or harder?
The universality of the stories. I mean, the exact same thing that you're talking about. And the elevated language, once you get accustomed to both hearing it and speaking it, it then becomes just such much a cooler way of talking. You know?
So can you give us like two lines of iambic pentameter?
I do not care to speak in verse, nor do I wish to try.
Oh, you're very good. he was really good. You know, the other thing is he must have really loved listening to conversations.
Yeah.
Because he gets the rhythms of English speech.
Yeah.
He really gets what it's like for people to amble from one topic to the next. And sometimes people jump around.
Well, and do you there's a theory that Elizabethan English was more similar to contemporary American speech.
Sure.
Is that a true thing?
Well, I think you should ask a linguist about that.
Okay.
But I think that... Well, I'll tell you first why I don't think that's true.
Okay.
People in the Elizabethan period were formally trained in rhetoric.
Yeah.
And that meant they read classical texts and they studied the turns of phrase. And they would keep notebooks called commonplace notebooks of, well, okay, if you... there were like, you know... bird spotters or something. They'd see this beautiful little turn of speech and they'd say, oh, that was a lovely chiasmus. I think I'll put it in my book.
Right.
And then I'll save it for some other time. So we don't really learn our language that way.
Yeah, right.
And I think also this is true about Shakespeare and his culture. It may have been true about ours 60 or 70 years ago, but they had a common text, which was the Bible, and they got a lot of stories from it. And they heard it on Sundays because by law they had to go to church.
Right.
And now you don't really have that tacit background of one text. Now there are many sacred texts, and we know a little bit about many of them, or maybe we know nothing. But I think it's harder for a writer to be doing certain moves and knowing that the audience will connect with, well, that's actually a lot like the prodigal son story. Oh, I get it. Yeah. King Lear is a kind of a prodigal son story where the father is the son. You know,
right. There were resonances for his audiences that sometimes contemporary audiences get and sometimes we don't get.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
But we also, I think Americans put a premium on not speaking overly formally.
Yeah.
I remember when Ross Perot was running for president.
Yeah.
He would say things that seemed really simple, like, we've got a problem with the economy. Open up the hood. See what's wrong. Fix it. Right?
Exactly.
Now, he was using a lot of one-syllable words. A lot of his words were Anglo-Saxon words. But it gives you a kind of a direct, to-the-point feel. But people in Shakespeare's world were also reading a lot of Latin, the ones who were literate. They were reading Cicero. And a Ciceronian sentence takes about 2 minutes to finish. Speaking a Ciceronian sentence is like juggling five balls at once. You throw one up, you start with a clause, and you say, okay, wait, you'll get to it. Then you throw up another three and grab the one as it comes down. And for us, it's hard to juggle that way. So I think that we're far from them in that sense. However, we do have technologies like Twitter, like Facebook, like the internet, that shoot certain phrases really quickly through our culture, and they take.
Yeah.
So I think we have a high level of wordplay with certain types of phrases, and that may be our way of connecting to a larger verbal world and network. It's not coming from a sacred text, but it is still something that's commonly shared.
Is it coming from the ground up now? Is it coming from the people?
I would never say that Shakespeare's world was one that was top down, because you hear Shakespeare pulling in lots of things from folk culture in his the back and forth between comic characters. You'll hear it, and I think it's on the ground history of the way people use words.
Yeah,
we get that in our popular culture. And we don't have what Shakespeare added to that in one form, which is a high culture or a high literate culture overlay that is coexisting with it.
Yeah.
So that's one of the great things about Shakespeare, I think, is that he figured out ways of drawing on these hyper-literate subcultures in his world where only a few percentage of the people were trained to read Latin, had commonplace books, would practice their spontaneous speech in their bedrooms before they went out to court. So there's that world.
Right.
But then there's the world of what's on the ground, what's in Southwark. When you walk across the London Bridge and you pass Southwark Cathedral, but then you're going by bear baiting arenas, you're going by whorehouses. You are hearing all of this language, and Shakespeare figured out ways of putting the two together. I'm not sure that I know of a contemporary artist who makes that link between high culture or the deep, long literary traditions and then popular. Probably the closest that I can think of, it's not a great example, but Bob Dylan, as a songwriter, is very good at linking the folk tradition or roots music in this country. But he's also, you'll hear references to Shakespeare and the Bible.
Yeah.
And it's that ability to put the things together that gives an artist real heft.
I'm Robert Siegel, and you're listening to the Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast. Always smart, often funny, and invariably brief.
Where can you RSC the RSC? This fall of 2011, we'll be touring the complete world of Sports Abridged in September with performances in Gainesville, Florida, Athens, Georgia, Decatur, Alabama, and New York City at the new Victory Theater on 42nd Street. We'll also be giving two performances of all the great books abridged at Pepperdine University in Malibu and Caltech in Pasadena, California. And we'll be premiering our eighth stage production, The Ultimate Christmas Show Abridged, at the Merrimack Repertory Theater in Lowell, Massachusetts. As always, the very best way to stay up to date about all of our worldwide performance dates is to sign up for the Reduced Reader, our email newsletter. Go to ReduceShakespeare.com and click on the link to subscribe and check out our touring page for specific box office, venue, and ticket information. And now back to my conversation with Michael Whitmore, who is not only the director of the Folger Shakespeare Library, he's also a client.
You're also an author, and didn't you do some research here at the Folger?
I did, yes.
What was that like? What is that like if you're not running the Folger, or if you're not taking the docent tour, or just coming into the gift shop? What's it like to be a scholar coming into the Folger Library and working?
I think the Folger Library is scholar heaven. Mm. It's great to be a teacher, and I think students are really the main audience for me as a former college professor, but I take seriously that you want to be in the classroom talking to people. However, it really matters when you can get 2 months to sit down with the original texts that were read and talked about by the people you study. And the Folger is a really rich collection in those texts. And we also have a community here of people who've read them.
Yeah.
So if you're going to go to tea and say to someone, you know, I'm working on this problem and I found it in this book or this manuscript, there are other people in the building who've read it and can tell you something about it. So that's a fantastic feeling of freedom. It's also a building that's dedicated to making scholarship work. The whole building is built so that that can happen. When I was in the reading room, everything else kind of disappears. It's a quiet space, and you're kind of left to the world of the imagination and trying to feel and think about what it was like to hold these texts in your hands or to write them.
Yeah.
So I love that part of the Folger. Folger and the subsequent curators of the library favored books that had marks by original readers. And that's really important because you can see how someone reacted to a book and what the book meant to them by seeing the marks that they left on them. It's also possible, and this is true of other collections of books, dealers of older books will sometimes dip the pages in bleach to get rid of the marks
so you can have a
clean copy. A so-called clean copy. Well, a clean copy means that you've lost all of this terrific information about what people felt or thought as they read. One of the greatest things about being in a really good research archive that is stuffed to the gills with material is that when you're working on one thing and you get interested in it, odds are that there's something interesting right next to it on the shelf.
Right.
And you'll find something you weren't looking for.
Yeah.
That's the greatest feeling.
Those happy accidents that can only happen when you're here.
Only happen when you're here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So in addition to being an historian, you're also bringing, I imagine, the new contemporary social media digital processes to a very old-fashioned, ways of looking at literature. How does that work?
I'll tell you, I think Shakespeare was already digital. there's a sense in which the world he lived in was already networked. It was networked through books, but it was also the network and the web was actually in people's minds.
Yeah.
You know, I think that we live in a world that is maybe we're very close to Shakespeare in this way. I think of Shakespeare as a man who had a brain that was incredibly networked. There were synapses jumping from one image to the next. But he didn't really need Google, you know?
Right. He was his own Google,
He was his own Google. It's a great way of saying it. And we live in a state of, I mean, I feel this sometimes, in a state of distraction because we can't associate so many things.
Yeah.
You just get on the keyboard and start doing Google searches, and suddenly you're reading Wikipedia entries about the, you know,
I can't even remember
Spanish Civil War. Yeah. You're thinking, well, how did I get there?
Well, I can't even remember my son's phone number because it's in my phone, and I don't need to because it's being remembered for me. So, is part of your job then as the sixth or seventh director of the Folger Shakespeare Library, is part of your job to then take this library with its 400-year-old technology of books?
Yeah.
Kicking and screaming into the 21st, 22nd centuries and beyond then?
Yeah. I think I'm trying to drag the 21st century kicking and screaming into its roots, which are either in the 16th century or they're further back in the 12th or the 11th.
Oh, cool.
I don't think a lot has changed mm-hmm. in terms of how our minds work. We just have different aids and hardware outside.
Well, and on top of everything else, on top of you being an author and a director and a scholar and an historian, you went to University of California at Berkeley.
I did, and I loved it. One of the great universities in the United States, a public university.
Well, we share that in common. We both went to Cal.
Oh, I didn't know that.
That seems like an interesting journey to go from Pentecostal evangelical to Berkeley, California. I mean, you are a man of parts.
That's a good way of saying it. I think I probably am a magpie. I try to take everything that I've done or experienced and keep it as one, you know, just don't throw it away.
Yeah.
It's important to kind of just try and keep adding.
It's useful. I mean, you seem to know Gilbert and Sullivan. You know, you're a musician. I mean, what all you got going on?
So I am a musician. I play, I was trained as a drummer and a bass player, and now I play mandolin. But I'm really interested in how people connect with performances. Mm. I think that's where the rubber hits the road. And here at the Folger, I also think that we do three things really well. We do performance, we do education, and we do scholarship. And they're all connected.
Yeah.
You think you're doing one, you know, actually you're also doing some of the other. Mm-hmm. So my philosophy is and, not or. How often do you use your history degree? Some people ask, what's the good of a humanities degree?
It's funny. In one way, I never use my history degree, ever. And in another way, yeah. I use it every single day.
Sometimes I feel like we need to have people like deans of law schools, deans of business schools, CEOs, members of Congress who got humanities degrees to stand up and say, you know what, this really helped me.
Yeah.
I can stand up as a scholar and say, reading Shakespeare is fabulous, and I can show you some of the reasons why I feel that way. But it prepares you for a lot of different things.
Yeah.
And I think it prepares you. I mean, you look at someone who can actually explain to you even just the plot of what happens at the end of King Lear.
Yeah.
I guarantee you that person could run a large organization.
Absolutely.
It really teaches you how to handle complexity. And, of course, it teaches you how to put yourself in another person's place.
That's it for this week's Reduced Shakespeare Company podcast. Send us the proof of your relevance 400 years later via email to feedback@reducedshakespeare.com. You can also post comments on our website podcast page, and you can post reviews on iTunes. You can interact with other fans at our website and our Reduced Shakespeare Company Facebook fan page. You can also become a subscriber to our YouTube channel or become a twit. Follow us on Twitter @Reduced. You can find easy links to all these social networks at our website, reducedshakespeare.com. Thanks, as always, to Webmaster Matt Rippey, Upstart Crow Matthew Croak, music by John Weber and Garage Band. Our random fan shout-out this week goes to Craig Harris. No reason, it's just random. Special thanks to everyone at the Folger Shakespeare Library, especially Stephen Galbraith for giving me and my family such a lovely impromptu tour, Garland Scott for the invitation, and director Michael Whitmore, whose own work, bringing the 21st century kicking and screaming back to the 11th or 12th, can be found at winedarksea.org. You can also begin to investigate the Folger's many holdings and resources on the web at folger.edu. Thanks also to Robert Siegel at National Public Radio, and thanks very much to you for listening. I'm Austin Titchener, 747/741st of the Reduced Shakespeare Company.
You're awesome, sir.
So are you.
This podcast is a production of the Reduce Shakespeare Company. Reducing expectations since 1981. Go to ReduceShakespeare.com for performance dates, actor bios, email newsletters, and so much less.
So much less. So much less.